That was the Main Street Blues by one of our favorite groups, the Red Stick Ramblers. You're tuned in to Sound Health on BBS Radio. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host for the next hour, and we're going to attempt to bring you information and ideas in support of self-health, like we do every Sunday. Our guest today is Dr. Davis Liu. He's the author of Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely. He's going to talk to us about how to be a smart healthcare consumer, how to control our own wealth, health, and healthcare costs. We'll be with Dr. Liu in just a few minutes after these brief announcements. Sound Health is sponsored by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology, located in southeastern Ohio. Actually, the Institute is the largest alternative health research facility in Ohio. They conduct research using the sound of the voice as a holographic representation of human psychology and physiology. Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, their project on Parkinson's, has opened its own voice analysis laboratory and has been following in the footsteps of the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology for a few years now, but for new and leading information, you're going to find that daily going on at the Institute. Some of their projects include temporal mandibular joint disorder studies. Most insurance companies spend an average of $6,000 to $8,000 on a patient with TMJ. That's when they can't open and close their jaws right. They have pain in their jaws. The Institute has shown that TMJ can be ameliorated for about a tenth of that cost, and we're looking for research subjects who can help us round out an article we're writing. So if you're suffering from TMJ, please get in touch at the Institute at 740-698-9119. Another one of their projects, vaccination risk intervention. We're still collecting data on vaccination risk. We recently used our predictive math matrix on using vocal sounds to show that quercetrin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-R-I-N, a biflavonoid, if it's high when a vaccination is administered, it reduces unwanted reactions. And that's some of Dr. Edith Sneed's work. And she says that that reduces cases of ADD and autism. Our studies here have also shown that this quercetrin helps reduce the risk of stroke and heart attack. And as some of you may remember, a few weeks ago, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny was on the show, and she postulated that the reactions from vaccine damage was very similar to the reactions from persons suffering from many MINI strokes. So if you're interested in participating in that study, please visit our website, Nutra, N-U-T-R-A, sounds.com, plural, nutrasounds.com, or our research site, JBAB, Journal of Bioacoustic Biology, jbab.org. There's several videos there showing some of the kids that we've worked with and reducing that damage. And last, I want to report on the project the Institute is doing with the Army, investigating the percentage of damage of soldiers who've been exposed to close proximity blasts, and that's in terms of traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. We want to train as many people as we can to use these computer programs that we've invented. So if you're interested in becoming involved in that and teaching or training, please get in touch with us at class@vocalprofiling.com, vocalprofiling.com. Okay, that's the end of announcements. Welcome to the show, Dr. Liu.
Thank you.
Is Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely your first book?
Yes, it is.
It certainly covers a lot of territory near and dear to our hearts, our health, our quality of life, our money. Who did you write this book for?
Well, actually, the book is really just for people like yourself and people who are very concerned about their health and where their money is going. You know, number one cause of personal bankruptcy these days is due to medical costs, and there's really no solution in sight. So people are really concerned about how they spend their money, how do they stay healthy. And the book's really written for people who don't have an insider. Certainly, as the only doctor in my family, if I wasn't a doctor, I probably would be equally as clueless as everybody else, wondering if they're getting the right care at the right time.
Well, people who are very wealthy have their own doctors and their own clinics and whatever, and people on the very low end have some government assistance in their health care. Do you think it's the middle class that's suffering, or the lower end where the government's sponsoring them? Who's really suffering here?
Well, I think unless you're Steven Spielberg, who has your own doctor for his family of four or five, I think we're all suffering. Research clearly shows in the United States we get the worst health care of any industrialized in the country. We spend more dollars per capita. We have an embarrassing number of people uninsured, 47 million. And despite spending more per dollar per man, woman, and child in this country, we actually die sooner than any other country in the world that's industrialized. So I'd say everyone except for the ultra-rich are actually suffering. It's our job as consumers to really figure out how to get the right care at the right time. Because actually within the country there are some great doctors and great hospitals that keep us healthy and well, and some are just frankly just poor. And so your job is to try to figure out which ones to are really good and worth your time and effort and which ones aren't.
I don't think people want to believe that. I don't want to believe it, that we're supposed to be one of the richest natures on the planet. Why do we have really cruddy health care?
Well, I mean, that's a whole other show, but basically the bottom line is this. We are a very rich nation, but the issue it becomes the basics of any healthcare system. You have to have a strong primary care network. You have to have lots of OBGYNs, pediatricians, internal medicine doctors, and family doctors to be able to do preventative care. And unfortunately, we know in this country that fewer and fewer medical students want to do preventative care. They're actually looking for specialty care because that's why our system pays more. It pays more for specialists, pays more for procedures, and frankly doesn't pay enough for people on the front lines who might prevent you from getting an open heart surgery, might prevent you from developing cancer early on in life. So that's actually part of the reason. The other part is 47 million don't have health insurance, and that becomes a major problem.
So they're just doing without?
Well, they're doing without. That's exactly right. They're struggling, and they're trying to figure out if they have a medical problem. They go to the emergency room and get what could have been a preventative problem treated at the very end. Going back to why does this country not do as well as other countries in the world, frankly, most of us, if not all of us, get health insurance through our employers, through our jobs. Any other country in the world, they actually don't have that sort of system. So it's a uniquely American problem, and it's going to need a uniquely American solution.
Well, is there any obligation of hospitals or emergency rooms to provide care to people who can't pay?
Well, for emergency rooms, there is an obligation for them to deal with emergencies. But the issue isn't the care. The issue is who's going to pay for that coverage. Because when someone has no health insurance and they go to the emergency room and get treated appropriately, there is some cost for the medications that were administered, the x-rays that were performed, the doctors and nurses and the professionalism who take care of it. And who gets paid for that cost if the person can't pay? You and I do. You and I get higher insurance premiums. The company that we work for are faced with higher insurance premiums. So, in fact, as a country, we pay more for health care, and that person who went to the emergency room for an emergency often might have been prevented. They had a heart attack. They had open-heart surgery. A lot of care is provided, a lot of appropriate care. But could that have been all avoided if that person had a regular primary care doctor who said, look, you need to quit smoking, let's put you on some medication, lower your cholesterol, and let's avoid that heart attack. So really the conversation in our country is we don't do the right things preventatively up front. Our doctors are too busy, and now more of us are facing high deductibles, and so we don't even know what we should get done because our doctors don't have time to tell us. And frankly, we're just confused with all the TV ads and everything that's blasted towards us daily to figure out what we need to do to stay healthy and well.
Isn't part of this the consumer's responsibility? Don't people know that smoking hurts them, that eating McDonald's 3 days out of five and fat and no exercise, isn't that just common sense that they're not taking care of their own health?
Well, I think that's a little more complicated than that. I mean, we kind of know that's not the right thing to do, but oftentimes you need someone to actually tell you that, like as your doctor, you know, I do think you need to lose weight. I do think you need to quit smoking. It's very different because, look, statistically, in this country, 2 out of 3 Americans are overweight or obese. We know children born in 2000 are more than likely not to live as long as their parents. The first time in a generation of Americans that won't live as long as their parents because of obesity, because of health-related problems. So I think, yes, it's common sense. But again, if you want to quit smoking and you've tried the patches and you need a prescription to try to get you to quit smoking, you don't have a doctor, or if you need gastric bypass surgery because you've tried everything else, and again, you don't have health insurance, then I'd say the system fails, and then we all fail. So it goes back to whose responsibility is this? Yes, consumers do have responsibility, but as I point out in my book, Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely, the healthcare system only gets it right half the time. So if you do have health insurance, you do see your doctor, they may forget to tell you to get your mammogram. They may forget to get your cholesterol under control. They may forget to address your blood pressure issue. So actually, I think the real solution is consumers do need to be aware that their doctors and their healthcare system fail them a lot more than they realize.
I'm going to ask a frivolous question, but I really have a good reason for asking it. Do you think it's true that an apple a day keeps the doctor away?
I don't know if that actually keeps the doctor away, but I think what it does point out is that healthy eating and being cognizant of it every day can definitely avoid problems. But if our health systems and health care was so simple, where just a simple intervention like that would be so profound and easy, I'd be recommending that every day. But certainly it does point out that a little bit done routinely can add up to a lot.
Well, this book is very attractive. Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely. Very attractive. It has a bunch of $100 bills on it, an apple, and a stethoscope. That's the reason I was asking about an apple a day. And I think people do associate in some way an apple with good eating, good health. I don't know who said an apple a day, maybe Edgar Cayce or somebody. But certainly something in an apple attracts people. I get to the point where I crave apples, and that's one of the things that attracted me to your book, this apple and a stethoscope on the front of it.
Yeah, the reason we chose that cover, in fact, is because it shows the intersection. Good health is, like you said, an apple is often perceived as healthy, thriving, natural. And the dollars is because, you know what, it takes more than just eating healthy. And the stethoscope also says, you know, sometimes you do need a doctor's help to keep you healthy. It's not that we want to, you know, start you on medications or treatments, but there are some things you have to do, because one of the most common things I see is people say, well, I feel healthy. Why do I need to see the doctor get a physical, or why do I need a mammogram or a colonoscopy? And I back up and say, look, you've got a car. Why do you take your car and get checked at 20,000 miles? It's running fine. And the answer is you don't want it to break down when you don't need it to break down. And our bodies are very similar. So there are some things doctors can do. There's sometimes you have to invest dollars to stay healthy, just like you would with your car. So actually the cover is really covering three elements, as you point out. It's got the apple for health. That's what we all aim for. And there's a lot of things we can do on our own. And it's got the dollars and stethoscope saying, look, there are times we need to invest in our health because it's the most powerful financial asset we own. And sometimes we do need to intersect with the healthcare system to make sure we're doing all the right things to stay healthy and well. So that cover actually was very deliberate. So thanks for pointing that out.
Do you think consumers have lost faith in their doctor's knowledge and an ability to take care of them, like in the 20s, 30s, even 50s, when the doctor was looked at as a friend? And I don't think people look at a doctor that way anymore.
I think that's the reason I wrote the book. Doctor visits are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, so you're feeling rushed. And then on top of that, you're feeling very insecure because there's so many ads on TV and there's so many people talking about, well, you'd be better sure you have this particular brand of medication because if you're not, you're not doing something right. And so there's always trying a fear of where you're doing right. Years ago, you know, two things really happened. One, doctors had more time. And two, frankly, technology was pretty behind the times. Recall that penicillin was only found in 1930 or so. So antibiotics have only been around for maybe 70 years. So years ago, a century ago, doctors could only hold people's hands and, you know, get them through illness. And now we have many more tools and x-rays and tests that we have at our disposal. So it's just frankly overwhelming. So too much technology, too many ads, not enough time to speak to a trusted authority like a doctor. And so no wonder people are frustrated and looking for alternative sources. That's why I wrote the book, because, again, as the only family member in my family who's a doctor, if I didn't go to med school and didn't really understand what was going on, I would probably be, frankly, as confused, frustrated, and frankly poor, I think, spending all these dollars and just wondering, am I getting the right care? Am I being shortchanged?
The book is very readable. All these little clipboards that you have on the side, that makes it so clear. I want to read that section. I want to read that section. So very nice book. I want to talk more about your book, but I want to give people the numbers to call us and ask questions to Dr. Liu. What kind of questions would you entertain, Dr. Liu?
Any healthcare questions, just think of me as a family friend. Think of me as a son or a brother who is a doctor and you've never had one before. Any questions I can answer for you, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Okay, the station numbers are toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. And worldwide, you can call at 877-489-6350. There is a direct line, 530-776-5154. And for our regular listeners who like to email us, I have the email up, and that's radio@vocalprofileinc.com. And if you would like to, I don't even know how to say that. I'm trying to read an email that just flashed in here. If you would like to call us, that's fine. Email us, that's fine. We'll try to read all of them that come in. Sometimes we can't get to all of them, but please keep them short. I just got one that's like 3 or 4 paragraphs here. I'm trying to munch through. So most of our people like to email us, so you can also...
Well, as you do that, let me remind your listeners that they have free book excerpts at my website they can download for free at www.davisluemd.com. That's DAVISLIUMD.com. There's wonderful book excerpts on how to communicate with your doctor, free downloads from the book itself. So hopefully they'll find some excellent tips on how to communicate well with their doctor as they navigate through an increasingly confusing and overwhelming healthcare system.
Yeah, lots of good puzzles there, too. Unless I got on the wrong site. Are you the one that put the puzzles up about the snails? And
I think that might be a different website, but I'll have to think about snails for a future upgrade.
It just has a bunch of puzzles. The questions are coming in already. Here's one. How has Big Pharma supported or interfered with quality health care?
That's a good question. I think Big Pharma interferes with quality health care in the following ways. Number one is they really push their products very hard on TV ads and magazines. What's shocking, which most people don't really realize, is they spend more money not marketing to you, the patient, the consumer. They spend most of their money marketing to doctors, actually, with dinners, free luncheons, free drug samples. So be very scared of pharma. One of the questions you should always ask your doctor if you get a prescription is, why this particular brand? Do I need this one, or is there another one that's less expensive but equally as effective? So time will tell. I think pharma is playing a very big influential role on doctors' judgment, even though doctors don't believe that to be the case. Medical schools these days and medical students are actually vowing not to take free samples, free pens, free cups from pharmaceutical reps anymore. So time will tell. But that does play a problem with our quality care.
Yeah, I think some states have even outlawed that. In doing some research for having you on the show, I read that in one article that $1 out of 5 that's paid for health care ever is spent on health care. That's pretty scary, that only one-fifth of what you pay for health care is spent on your health care.
Well, I'm not sure what study you looked at. I think
it was
one day
an article. It was an article on the Physicians for National Health Program.
It's hard to say where they got their data. I mean, when they say that, I think it's a little misleading to say healthcare, because healthcare we define in multiple ways. Is it the doctors that get paid? Is it the drugs that get covered? Is it the hospital? Is it the insurance? I think they're trying to say that 80% of healthcare costs go to administrative costs. That's not actually true. I think there's a lot of issues of, for example, how good are doctors? If you have a doctor and you have a bunch of specialists, you might be shocked to discover they never talk to each other. They all seem to be in a vacuum. They don't know who's doing what. It seems like they're on different planets. So is that an extra healthcare cost? It is. It's a big coordination issue. I will tell you what I thought you were going to say was how much healthcare is going to cost this country. In a few years, every dollar spent in the U.S. economy was being spent on healthcare. 20% of our gross domestic product will be spent on healthcare in the next 5 years. That is shocking. 20% of our national productivity will be spent on healthcare costs.
In the beginning of your book, you talk about healthcare reform and the government's role in healthcare. Can you share a little bit of that with our viewers or listeners?
Sorry. Yeah, so healthcare reform is nothing new. They've been talking about this for decades. I mean, going back as early as Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s and Medicare. But obviously the situation is getting worse. And there's really two thoughts right now. There's the Republican plan, which is more individual coverage. And there's the Democratic plan, which is using the government to cover those who don't have health insurance. In a nutshell, the Republicans are saying that you as an individual should have the opportunity to buy your own health insurance, and that way you're not stuck at your job, and you can leave your job, and your health insurance will follow you. Because the biggest fear people have these days, if they quit their job and move somewhere else, they may not have health insurance. And the Democrats, frankly, want that similar thing, except for those that don't have health insurance, to buy into a government plan. So we'll see which plan actually pans out. My sense is, however, as especially with the recent events, I don't think healthcare reform is going to happen anytime soon. And so now it's going to be thus thrust between those who are insiders and who know what they need to do to get done and those who are frankly oblivious. And my book's really to give the edge to those of us who are kind of oblivious, don't have a doctor in the family, not really have good rapport with our doctors, to get the insider knowledge, to get the scoop on what we must do to stay healthy and well. So if there's a time the healthcare system gets reformed, we don't have to do that. But actually, I've been more pessimistic as the year has gone on, and I don't see any sort of a major healthcare reform going forward.
Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely by Dr. Davis Liu, if you've just joined us. Dr. Liu, I love the subtitle, Making Intelligent Choices in America's Healthcare System. How can we do that?
You've got to educate yourself. You've got to realize a couple of key facts. Number one, your doctors, as nice as they are, although some have terrible bedside manner and frankly could be labeled as just jerks, a lot of doctors have excellent bedside manner, actually don't do the right care. Research consistently show we get the wrong diagnosis probably half the time. We don't get the right test done. We don't get the right preventive care. We forget to get you immunized. We forget to give you colon cancer, mammograms, cholesterol checks, blood pressure control. We forget, not because we mean to, but because we're extremely busy. Not an excuse. That's just a failure of our system. And so the choices that you need to make is you've got to just educate yourself. And I wrote the book in an easy-to-read fashion, so it's like having a cup of coffee with a doctor for maybe 4 or 5 hours and saying, what's the real story? How can I not get schnookered by all these expensive ads on TV? When can I see a doctor, and when can I safely avoid seeing a doctor? Because oftentimes people will kind of come into the office when they're practically on death's door, and then we have to send them to the emergency room, and they get hospitalized. How can you avoid those things? And what is the truth about what treatments are out there? What tests do I need to get done so I can stay healthy and well? Because in this country, we're spending way too much money on care that doesn't even make us live as long as the other industrialized countries in the world. And it's going to get worse.
And on the other side of that, I think some doctors forget that we are the consumers and we have something to say. I'm going to try to make this really short. I recently went to the hospital because every time I swallowed, something was sticking me in the back of my throat, and this started on Friday. My doctor wasn't in. I didn't want to go to the emergency room for something so stupid, so I waited till Monday to call my doctor. He sent me to the emergency room anyway, they did x-rays, they did examinations, they stuck stuff up there, they stuck my head in this tube-looking thing and looked inside me. They found nothing. They finally decided they were going to give me something through my veins, and I told them I did not want these students working on me because I have strange veins anyway. They did anyway. I got a big blood blister-looking thing in the back of my hand, and they decided that I was pre-stroke and that my brain was just sending signals places where it shouldn't. Well, I finally got out of there after 4 or 5 hours, went home, took one of those toothpicks that flush water up into your teeth, and put that back in the back of my throat and flushed out a nut hole.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just kind of nutty. All of those tests probably cost my insurance company thousands of dollars. Okay, do something reasonable. Flush it out with water and kind of see what's up there. You know, that's just kind of a nutty way to handle something when I'm trying to say there's something sticking me up in the back of my throat.
And so, here's the thing. You already instinctively said, as a reasonable person on Friday, hey, this is not an emergency. I will wait the entire weekend and talk to my doctor on Monday. Because I know, as a reasonable person, what is an emergency. And on Monday, your doctor said to go to the emergency room. And being the good patient that you are, said, okay, but somehow instinctively you probably felt this was wrong. And as you went to the emergency room, you probably had a cascade of things happen. You go, this isn't right. And as you point out at the very end, it cost us, you, me, everyone, insurance company, like thousands of dollars that's going to come back on our premiums next year. And so what I say to you, you may want to find another doctor, or you're going to have to hold your ground here, because it sounds like that was a trip that you didn't need. And it sounds like that was a lot of time that you spent in a hospital that really wasn't necessary. And, of course, more importantly, that bed was taken up by somebody who might have needed it, too. So everyone was inconvenienced. So my books try to give people the empowerment to realize, look, you know, doctors, although we are have knowledge and we're experts, we're not perfect. And sometimes you have to speak out on your behalf and say, you know what, I don't think so. I really think it's this and that. And if the doctor doesn't listen to you, you know, find another one. Find another one who really listens to you and understands you as a person and doesn't try to shove you to different places where you may not need to go.
And it brings me to a question I want to ask about your book. You talk a lot about how to get the best information to your doctor so they can understand, and also how the doctor can get the best information out of you. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, so what happens is, you know, most people get interrupted in 23 seconds of seeing a doctor. That's the average time doctors wait before they start talking. So it's important that you get the information that you need out there before the doctor stops you. So I talk about thinking about, like a reporter, you talk about the four W's, the what, the where, the when, and the why. You talk about your symptoms in that order. Because 90% of getting the right diagnosis is listening to the patient. It's not all the fancy tests. In fact, you just gave a great example. If they actually spent some time and listened to your story, they would have realized it doesn't sound like a pre-stroke. You probably didn't need an IV. They probably should have looked really, really carefully in your throat. But they didn't do that, because our system actually pays for getting a CT scan, pays for drugs, pays for IVs, and so it helps you avoid unnecessary costs by trying to get that information out to your doctor before they start making knee-jerk reactions, which often the patient pays the price, not so much the doctor.
So we should be prepared as patients before we go to the doctor to explain as much as we can?
Well, what I do in the book is I talk about how you can do it succinctly. So if you had back pain, you basically tell a doctor, if this is what happened, you know, doctor, I've had back pain for 2 weeks. It's worse when I bend over. It's better when I stand up. I've tried Tylenol, which seems to help. Never had this before in the past. You know, it's keeping me up at night. I'm really worried it might be cancer. What I just say in those brief sentences there, probably took less than 25 seconds. The what, back pain. The where, low back. What makes it better, what makes it worse? Bending, standing, medicine. What am I worried about? I'm worried about cancer. And why am I there? And so basically, you can very quickly tell the doctor. But oftentimes, in my experience, when patients come in, they kind of say, well, doctor, I'm here for back pain. And that's it. They don't really elaborate. And so then I have to ask them questions. And if you're lucky, you have a doctor who actually cares and listens. he or she may ask you, well, how long has it been? What have you tried? What makes it better or worse? What makes you most worried about this? If you're unfortunate and have a doctor who's just really trying to get to the next patient because they're paid for more patients they see, the more they get paid, they get back pain. Okay, great. I'll give you some medicines. Off you go. So that's really why it's important, because 90% of what we diagnose, how we get it right, is what you tell us. It's kind of like when you watch a movie. You kind of think you know where the story goes, and you make some conclusions. Sometimes they're erroneous, because you watch the movie unfold, you realize it goes a totally different direction. Well, doctors can't read the story unless you tell us your story. So if you're skilled and you know how to tell the story in a succinct manner, and that's what my book talks about, is how you do it quickly and succinctly so you're heard. Because otherwise doctors cut you off in 23 seconds, and they often jump to the wrong diagnosis, winds up costing you time and money, if not harm.
It's really hard, though, to interrupt the doctor and say, no, I don't think that's what it is. We're afraid to say that.
You should not be. If there's anything about the book, and that's why I think power comes from knowledge, that's why I wrote Intelligent Choices, America's Healthcare System. The book is easy to read, because once you're empowered, you go, no, that's not quite what I just said, or no, that's not what I meant. You absolutely should say that, because remember, I am trying to hear your story. I don't have your symptoms. I'm not you. So, again, it's kind of like watching a movie unfold and seeing where the story goes. If it goes a different way, it's because you waited. Or I tell people, they say, well, I can't describe my pain. I can't describe my symptoms. I say, you know what? You have to. I'll wait a few seconds because you've got to describe it. So I try to describe a wine you're sipping. You can't describe it to me what's going on. Then I'm going to make some assumptions, and those assumptions might be wrong. And who pays the price? You do. So it's important that you know how to do it succinctly. Again, I've talked about the technique in my book, and I find it's very helpful, because when patients tell me their symptoms very succinctly, but yet detailed enough where I can get the diagnosis, you know what? Makes my job easier. I just sit back and listen. But if a patient comes in and says, Doc, I've got chest pain, and there's nothing else they can tell me, what makes it better, what makes it worse, have they had it before? Have they tried? Guess what I've just done now? I've got to order a bunch of blood tests, got to order a CAT scan, treadmill, all the other tests, because I have the foggiest deal we have. So it's kind of, I just have to shoot a shotgun, basically, and just hope I hit something. That's not the kind of care you want. So you've got to take the effort, and yes, it's okay to interrupt your doctor. Guess what? If your doctor says he's upset at you and just says that, find another doctor. There's plenty of great doctors out there. You do not need to find one that doesn't listen to you.
We have about 7 questions here. Here's one. I'm going to sort of try to shorten it. I'm a note taker. I made a list of my symptoms and took them to my doctor. He said to me, anyone with this kind of list is likely to just be anxious. I'll prescribe an anti-anxiety. What do you think?
Fascinating, isn't it? Did the doctor even talk to the person? Group your symptoms briefly into some sort of order. Don't write a laundry list. And obviously, I don't know the symptoms, so my job here is not to give medical advice. But use your instincts, just like you did about your throat experience. If this patient feels like the symptoms sound like anxiety, then that might be reasonable. But if you feel like something's wrong, you say, you know what? I know anxiety. This doesn't sound like anxiety. Could it be a thyroid condition? Could it be some other things that look similar like anxiety? Then go back to your doctor and say, look, I understand you think of it, but what else could it be? Because if you're not convinced that's what it is, then you've got to wonder if the doctor made the right diagnosis. It goes back to that. So be when you write down your symptoms, try to be specific and try to engage. I think lists and giving a doctor a list of symptoms are helpful, but then you've got to kind of flesh out the story a little bit, because, you know, it's like cooking. You know, I can look at a cookbook and kind of cook, but as long as I need a chef, they actually show me what I need to do. So the symptoms you give to the doctor is kind of helpful as a starting point, but that should not be speaking for you. You should be speaking up for yourself.
Well, what this lady is indicating is the doctor said the fact that she wrote all of this down for him meant that she was likely an anxious person. So the fact that she took him a list,
that's an erroneous assumption, isn't it? Because I can tell you, a lot of people I take care of are engineers, electrical engineers who work at computer high-tech industries. And what do? They write stuff down, because engineers, by their nature, write all kinds of stuff down. So it doesn't mean anything. The doctor made an assumption. Maybe the person is nervous. I've got a lot of patients who are not nervous at all. They're lawyers, they're business people. They just want to have a list, kind of like they have a shopping list to keep their mind focused. I write things down all the time. I'm hardly nervous. So I don't think that's true. I think that's an erroneous assumption. That's why I said pieces of paper are our starting point. You should speak up for yourself and make sure it's clear what's going on.
Boy, here's another question. I wish I'd asked this one because it's great. What do you think our present food supply has to do with our bad health?
Well, I'm assuming the present food supply being the types of foods that we have versus processed, fast food, and I think it's bad. I mean, we know statistically 2 in 3 adults in this country are overweight or obese. Not by accident. Not that Americans are lazy. It's because the foods that surround us, the systems around us, the food systems around us are actually just unhealthy. Portion sizes are much bigger these days. The way our environment is, where we're less active, we're on the road more. These are all leading towards bad health. So yes, our food system around us actually is playing a big role with our poor health habits. And we're actually exporting that worldwide. So other countries like China, India, who have these fast food companies, are finding that their waistlines are increasing as well.
Well, she talks about French fries, sugared cereal, fast food restaurants, da-da-da.
I agree. Our system around us is unhealthy, and as more Americans choose to find unhealthy foods, companies are empowered to make more fast food choices. So again, as a consumer, what can you do to promote good health? But again, it's very hard because if you are busy, you've got 2 kids, you've got 2 jobs, you've got things to do, and you don't have time to make dinner, you don't have time to pick healthy choices, then of course, exactly as the person says, our system itself actually gives us bad health.
Okay, this is another audience question. As a doctor, does the drug ads on TV help or hurt you in helping diagnose a patient? I think what they really mean is them listing all the symptoms this could be, and a person comes in and says, well, I need this because the drugs add blood cells.
Right. So I was going to say the answer depends on how you frame the question. Okay. And what I mean by that, if you said, you know, doctor, I'm concerned about peripheral artery disease or PAD, you'll see that on TV a lot, because I have these following symptoms. Okay. And you tell them the symptoms just like the ad says. Say, do you think that's what it really is, or is it something else? See, now that a doctor can kind of jump in and says, well, you know, there's a lot of other things that can cause that. But if you come and says, well, I'm convinced I have this, and I need this drug, then that hurts us. I'll tell you how I know that. Because in medical school, when we're training, we're just like the rest of the public. We don't have the knowledge. We don't have the experience. We just read stuff out of textbooks. And in third and fourth year med school, we joke about this, but it's actually true. When we read about an illness, we all feel like we're coming down with it. So we read about meningitis, a little fever, a little headache, right? We all have had colds before, right? Got a little fever, a little headache, a little chills, maybe eyes hurt a little bit. Read about meningitis, they talk about photophobia, you know, can't look at bright light. And we're saying we have meningitis. And so, you know, third and fourth year medical students actually scare themselves often enough. They may actually end up in the emergency room or doctor's office. So I tell people it's a good starting point to have a conversation. But as soon as you say, I need this, or I'm sure I have this, then you're really neglecting the experience part, because it's just words. They may not apply to you. And so if you want to say, you know, I saw this, I'm worried about this, is it this or could it be something else, then it's actually very helpful.
Another question. Do you recommend or welcome, discourage people to write down their histories, their experiences, questions to give to the doctor to deal with the 23-second interruption issue you mentioned?
Yeah, so first of all, I don't advocate that people just give doctors lists, because you need to control the interview. As soon as the doctor controls the interview, your say is pretty much done. But I do say this, and I talk about this in my book. Set up the agenda early. Say, look, Dr. Smith, I've got 3 things I want to talk about today. I want to talk about my chest pain. I want to talk about this ankle injury I had 5 years ago, and I want to talk about my problem sleeping. So I've said it very clearly. I want chest pain, ankle problem, and difficulty sleeping. That's my 3 top things. Well, let me go over which one you want to talk about today first. That way you set up the agenda. So that way the doctor doesn't really take control of the interview. The other thing I would also tell people is always put the most important problem first. Don't ever say, you know, chest pain at the end of your visit as if we're about to leave, because we'll definitely be upset. And not only that, you might get short end of the stick, because we might order a bunch of tests you really didn't need had we spent more time just talking to you. So I don't recommend handing lists over. I do recommend saying what I'd like to talk about today. I would also recommend you make the list no more than four items, like four different items, because research shows from the Mayo Clinic, patients will remember half the stuff we tell them. So if you make the list really, really long, you're not doing yourself a favor. You're actually probably cutting yourself short, because the doc's not going to really investigate anything very thoroughly, rather too superficially.
Okay, another audience question. You just mentioned peripheral artery disease that deals with inflammation. I've been reading a lot about stroke and diabetes and how they're also a part of inflammation. Is this an epidemic, or am I just concerned about nothing?
They're all related. Inflammation, diabetes, peripheral artery disease, they're all related. It is an epidemic. You're not wrongly concerned. If you have symptoms, you should ask your doctor. But again, as I was saying earlier, be open-minded. Say, you know, I thought I'm worried about this. Do you think that's what it is? Because once you come in and say, you know, I think I have this, I need this drug, research shows doctors will write you the prescription. And then they surveyed them afterwards, and most of them were very ambivalent. But because they're crushed for time, not that I'm excusing that, they feel that that's what you want, and you'll be unhappy unless you get what you want. They'll write it for you. And now who's going to be in danger? You are. So, yes, it's a real epidemic. They are related. So if you're worried, please check with your doctor and be open-ended about it. Say, I'm concerned about these things. Do you think that's what I have, or is it something else I'm worried about?
What's causing all this inflammation?
Well, it goes back to the first question about the bad food choices.
So is it like lack of fatty acids or...
No, it's gonna be lack of exercise. We know in research that lack of exercise. Yeah, lack of exercise. We know that certain foods, fatty foods, cause more antioxidants. We know it causes more inflammation. We know it causes clogging of the arteries. Well, clogged arteries from cholesterol plaques causes inflammation because the body doesn't like it in the arteries. So it's a cycle. Diabetes causes sugar to stick to different blood cells and blood vessel walls, and that causes inflammation. So it goes back to everything. That's why the book is called Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely. In fact, one part we didn't talk about in the book, we talked about how to avoid seeing us. You know, you need to see us for preventive care. But I talk a good part of it about the boring, dumb, unsexy stuff no one ever talks about, kind of smirks. And like you said, the consumers, as patients, we should know. Exercise every day. Start with 5 minutes every day. Try to build up to 30 minutes most days of the week. Don't smoke. Get a healthy weight. This is easy to say, a lot harder to do. But in fact, that is what prevents the inflammation that your other listener was alluding to.
Okay, another audience question. And then I want to get to this health savings account I want to talk about. Topic, state of mind, attitude. What experiences have you had in your practice that shows the effect of a patient's state of mind, and that's capitalized, / attitude on their well-being? Perhaps an example or two.
Well, I mean, that's an area of extensive research, and it certainly helps people cope with illnesses and serious illnesses like cancer and other things. Right now, it's unclear whether that state of mind, like a really good positive state of mind, helps better outcomes. But I would say this, state of mind alone doesn't mean you'll be healthy. In other words, you shouldn't skip necessary tests, procedures, interventions, things like that, just because you have an excellent state of mind. I've got patients who are excellent health, do everything right, and they're shocked to find that they have some sort of deadly illness or serious problem. And I tell people, it's like driving a car. You may be the safest driver in the world. You may have the safest car in the world. You may do everything right, and darn it, some yahoo just runs a red light. So that can happen. So having an excellent state of mind certainly does everyone better, and I think the families and the patient copes better. Outcomes, not sure yet. Research doesn't show that they're necessarily doing any better, but certainly they can't do any worse.
Another audience question. You mentioned inflammation. Does things like mangosteen and Zango and some of these drinks really help as antioxidants?
Well, there's no research on that. Despite what you may read, I'm always a little leery of things that, you know, that sound too good to be true. There is no such thing as a free lunch in this country, or life for that matter. So certainly if you think that helps a little bit, absolutely. Would I ask you to spend a lot of money on that? Probably not. What I'd ask you to spend money on is maybe a nice pair of walking shoes. and maybe a little routine to get you going, get that heart rate up a little bit. I'd spend more money on that and maybe a little less. If you want to do that, that's fine, but I would not bet the farm on that. I'd bet the farm on little basic things, on eating healthier and losing some weight and staying active.
Okay, in your book, you talk about the health savings account, the HSA. Would you talk about that a bit?
Sure. HSAs are basically a thing that was started in 2004. It allows people to put away money, squirrel away money for future health care costs. The money is tax-free, so you put money aside from your paycheck, goes into your bank account called a health savings account, and you can withdraw the money tax-free on medical-related expenses. You can invest the dollars like you would any other investment, and also you can carry it with you, so if you leave your job, the health savings account goes with you. The only catch is, to have a health savings account, you have to have a health insurance plan that has a high deductible, and you'll know that because if you go through open enrollment through your employer, or when you buy health insurance, they'll tell you if an account is health savings eligible. So that's just a new tool. You just have to be aware of that. The advantage of that is actually the monthly premiums are cheaper because you have a high deductible plan. Kind of like auto insurance. The higher the deductible, the cheaper your monthly premiums. So health savings account, new way to save for health care expenses. You can carry the money over with you when you move from job to job. And, in fact, if you don't spend the money and you're not obligated to, you can actually use the money for retirement when you retire at 65.
So this is something that has to be done through your employer.
It has to be done if you have a health insurance plan that allows you to have a self-savings account. So individuals can purchase high-deductible insurance plans and have a health savings account.
Okay, this is a very long email. I don't dare cut any of it out, so I'm just going to read it as it came in. From Dr. Lou's site, the CDC reported a large increase in the number of measles cases. An outbreak in Illinois occurred in homeschooled children. None were vaccinated. Already in 2008, 131 cases were reported, which is three times that of 2007. And before the measles vaccine in this country, there were 400 deaths of U.S. children each year caused by measles, says Dr. William Schaffner, Department of Preventive Medicine, chairman of the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Measles carries serious complications, including pneumonia and encephalitis, which is life-threatening inflammation of the brain tissue that can be caused by viral infections such as measles. Measles is a serious illness. To be cavalier and not vaccinate shocks someone like me who has seen the devastating effects of the disease. And then they also put in here, from Dr. Tenpenny's book on vaccinations, the quote by Meyer Eisenstein, MD, JD, saying no to vaccines is recommended for all professionals involved in the treatment of children. All parents, grandparents, those concerned about mandated vaccines, and all politicians, members of administrative bodies and medical societies who have the responsibility of passing vaccine legislation that impact our children should say no to vaccines. Goes on to say that with Dr. Eisenstein, he's never seen a case of autism in a child that has never been vaccinated. And then in great big letters, who are we supposed to believe?
You know, it's like anything else. You get a bunch of friends and family together, can you get any of them to agree? Here's the thing. Measles is an easily preventable disease. If you want to avoid your child and having the vaccine, then I'd argue the state has an authority not to let your kid in public school, because you're threatening their other kids. And so you notice the case was all these kids were homeschooled, so in one sense that was contained. But now guess who bears the brunt of dealing with the health care costs? We as a nation do. So yes, you can find all kinds of pundits and people telling you what's true and what's not true and who do you believe. You've got to trust your gut a little bit. You've got to ask your doctor. I mean, if you ask me right now, do I vaccinate my kids? The answer is yes. All of them have been vaccinated for exactly the illnesses you talked about. I'm a strong believer in prevention. Is there a link with autism? We don't know. There's a major research going on. We'll find out. But right now, there's nothing that's definitive. But we'll see. But I think you've got to trust your gut as a parent. But I do think that parents who say, you know what, I have a right to go to school, public school, and I don't want my kid vaccinated, I actually disagree. That's a public safety issue, and I think the states are having their full rights to have kids stay away from school if they don't get vaccinated for the safety of our kids, all our kids.
Another audience question. We hear that healthcare is so expensive because of malpractice insurance going up. Do you believe malpractice insurance premiums being so high is because of doctor incompetence or consumer greed?
Well, first of all, healthcare costs if you ever get a soundbite from anybody that says healthcare costs because of high malpractice or this or that, it's never true. It's actually a whole bunch of issues. But part of the healthcare cost being so expensive is, number one, we have 47 million uninsured, and number two, as a country, we don't focus on preventative care. Certainly, malpractice insurance are going up, but that isn't the only reason healthcare is becoming more expensive. Because as a country, we don't focus on prevention, we focus on after the fact, after the complications. And so that's really what's driving it.
Well, there's an issue, too. We did a study here at Sound Health on gout, and we found frequencies that would help take away gout pain.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the idea to a couple of podiatrists, and they were not interested. They said, why would we want that? It would just take away from our bottom line. So we learned not to go to the doctors that we would be interfering with the research that we do.
Yeah, there's a lot of perverse incentives out there. Like I said, we have more specialists probably per capita than any other country in the world. So that's the challenge. We need more preventative care. We need upfront care before patients have symptoms so everyone can have access to great care.
We only have a couple more minutes here. I want to ask you, what do you think the biggest threat is to individual health care today?
Well, the biggest threat is it's unaffordable. The biggest threat is unaffordable, and that people are going to skip care when they should invest their dollars, because what they don't realize is the most powerful financial asset they own is the ability to stay healthy and well. Because if you're healthy and well, you can always earn and make more money, but if you're not well, doesn't matter how much money you have, you can never gain it back. And these times where the economy is tanking, where the home prices are falling, you need great health to stay healthy and well. My biggest fear is as healthcare becomes unaffordable, people will skip care, easily preventative, easily taken care of at much cheaper so they can live a long time. In fact, find out it does staying illness, spend their whole life savings and then some, and then find out they don't live very long at all. So that's my biggest fear, the unaffordability issue and then people not getting the right care they deserve.
Well, Amazon gives this book 5 stars, great praise. We have more questions on dietary supplements, how you feel about alternative health care, the truth about generic and branded medications, but we are out of time.
Just remind them that a lot of that actually is covered in the book, Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely, and free excerpts on my website at davisluemd.com to give them a flavor of what we do cover. But a lot of those things were addressed. Because, again, this is a book kind of where, as if I had a cup of coffee with you for about 5 or 6 hours and tell me, what is the truth about all that stuff? What do I really need to know? So I hope people really enjoy and really empower themselves to make intelligent choices so they are staying healthy, living longer, and spending wisely.
You can get it at Amazon for $18.96, and it's also available on Kindle for $7.99. I love my Kindle. It's a book reader kind of thing.
Yeah, we wanted to be up on the forefront. We wanted to keep up with the people in technology at the forefront, so we've got an electronic version. And, of course, people who want autographed copies can go purchase directly from my website as well.
That is great. Stay Healthy, Live Longer, Spend Wisely by Dr. Davis Liu. It's a good advice for intelligent people who can take the time and have the money to oversee their own health care needs. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to be with us, Dr. Liu. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. Thanks to the Institute of the Bioacoustic Biology that creates software in support of our inner selves. Please join us on Thursday for Vocal Profiling Live. We'll be evaluating the vice presidential debates. We'll look at those vocal prints of Joe Biden and Sarah Palin for truthfulness, intent, and stress. This is BBS Radio. Thank you for listening.
What do I do?